From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Today on the show, we'll hear about what young activists are requesting from the state to be more accountable for racial justice. Plus, two filmmakers speak about how film can be one of the best tools to help create understanding around the issues surrounding protests worldwide.
I think it has limits in what it can do as well, and that it needs to be done in conjunction with other means of education and, you know, consciousness. But it is the age, it is how people communicate, it's how people are impacted, how people see the world.
Plus, we look back on the fair housing marches in Milwaukee and the parallels to the protests happening today.
It happened in 1967 in Milwaukee when people started to come from all over the country to participate here. And it's happening now. Love is more powerful than hate.
Lake Effect is next, but first the news. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Thanks for tuning in today. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. On March 31st, the youth activist group Leaders Igniting Transformation, also known as LIT, submitted a list of demands to the state, city, and county on ways to move the needle on racial justice. They want the state to declare racism a public health emergency, cut all policing from Milwaukee public schools. They also want law enforcement to stop accepting federal surplus of military weapons and invest in schooling, healthcare, and drinking water. LIT also wants to see a racial equity audit in all public institutions. As of recording this, LIT hasn't received an official reply from the government. Lake Effect's Julian Haida recently spoke with one of the letter's authors, Daryl Gibson.
Early this month, Attorney General Bill Barr ordered peaceful demonstrations in front of the White House in D.C. to be dispersed by federal troops. Now, our former governor, Scott Walker, tweeted, "It's hard to imagine any other POTUS having the guts to walk out of the White House like Trump did." Of course, he walked out of the White House because the protests had been violently dismantled and he wanted a photo op in front of a church across the street. Now, Governor Walker, Republican. Meanwhile, Governor Evers, his successor, is a Democrat, and he's ordered more policing in Wisconsin, including invoking the National Guard. So I think some people, perhaps only white people, I don't know, assume that a lot of this unrest boils down to partisanship. Do you think that's the case?
That's actually a great question. And to really break that down, it's not. This is not a partisan issue. Let's be very clear. The injustices that happened in this country has happened under Democratic and Republican leadership. This is what it is. It is a racial issue in this country. It's around police brutality. It's around divesting from Black communities. It's around criminalizing a person for their skin color. Unfortunately, it doesn't fall under a Republican's jurisdiction or a Democrat's jurisdiction. So no, it's not a partisan issue. It's a humane issue. It's a society issue. It'd be great that our elected officials would take up the mantle and seem to try to solve this. But, you know, we hold blame in all who are in power and continue to let this happen. Voting is a part of that, right? But this is a systemic white supremacy issue. It goes beyond elected parties or voting or polling locations. I can't go to vote if I am dead in the street from the hands of a police officer or an individual who sees me as a threat because I'm Black. I need to be recognized as a person, as a man, and as an individual as equal to others before my voice can even be recognized. I don't think we're there as a country yet. I think we have an illusion that we're there. But systemically, again, look at where we are and look at how this continuously repeats itself. If we were past racism, if my voice was truly counted, we would not be having this conversation today, would we?
I think you're absolutely correct. You've certainly brought attention through civil disobedience. You have kind of made your voices heard. And what I'm hearing, too, is this is a pressing issue. This is an issue that can't wait, whether it be to November or 4 years. Conversations that we're having now haven't happened since the assassination of Dr. King. So are you hopeful, at the very least, that you are kind of sparking conversations that kind of haven't happened in a long time? Or are you worried that this is all going to just happen again and people are going to continue tokenizing and marginalizing Black voices?
To be honest, I'm numb. I'm numb to hope. I'm numb to optimism. I'm numb to really the future. And what I mean by that is that, unfortunately, I can't read the future. I can't understand the past and historical context and looking at trajectory of this country from when my ancestors landed on this country 400 years ago. What that has taught me is that there are peaks and valleys in the race and a journey to make everyone equal and equitable here in this country. Like you said, civil disobedience is one way of going about it. Other ways is having tragic moments in history cause true change. Right now, we're at a point where the voiceless are in the streets protesting. We have allies here protesting. But again, that's just us saying that we need to be heard. What really needs to be happening and what needs to happen are those in power taking those people who are voiceless, who are demoralized, who are criminalized, and hearing them and seeing and causing true systemic long-term change. I don't understand the concept of why people feel this is a matter of which you can hold on and wait to the polls or wait till we have majority in one house or another. Again, why is my life, why is the life of Black women and other Black men in this country always put on hold? Always. We are recognized as one of the most talented, one of the most beautiful, one of the most culture leading ethnicities in this country. But yet when it comes to making sure our life matters, that we are safe, that we are thriving, that we are equal, it's always on the back burner. As Tony Evers rolled out his statement around the defunding the police, he said he doesn't see that happening. And he said the justification is that he sees people who join the police force have good hearts. And in some instance, to the extent, yes, or have good intents, I think was the direct quote or something along those lines. They had good intents to serve the community, right? My question to Tony Evers and to everyone out there is, what do we do with all these bad apples that we keep seeing in our police departments across the country to deter them from being bad apples? There's industries and professions in this country and in this world that you cannot afford to have bad apples in. And it seems that our policing entity is one that is always excused for the bad apples, but there's no repercussions. There's no deterrent for bad apples to exist. And again, it belittles my life to see that in this occasion, bad apples only and might, at the best scenario, lose their job for killing me.
I can't even imagine if, for example, a nuclear power plant operator, you know, notwithstanding the issue of race, but was a bad apple and turned the dials and all of a sudden we have a Chernobyl in Wisconsin. I mean, that's a bad apple situation.
So again, why is it that that's excusable, but this is not excusable? Like, I don't understand the concept. And then that's why the whole fact of systemic white supremacy and racism is so important that we need to address in our government institutions. That's the practice of that, to say my life is not valuable enough to at least review the practices and procedures of our institutions to make sure everyone is equitable, is racist. That's practicing white supremacy. I won't stand for that. Again, it's been days since we sent a letter to Governor Evers, Mayor of Milwaukee, Tom Barry, County Executive David Crawley, and no answer, no sit down, no moving forward. What are we waiting for? Why is there no urgency to get and solve this issue? But the first thing that was done was not to have a community conversation, not to put everything on the table and say, hey, let's, how do we get past this? But was to call in the National Guard. That was the first answer to our pain, to our hurt, to our sorrow for generations. That's the first answer. So again, as American, I think I have to have some level of hope to be in society. But as a Black man, and from the actions that I continuously see, no, I don't have hope. I'm lost.
Well, I imagine the other side, not to say there are two sides, feels scared, but that is a kind of a racist kind of feeling, in the sense that it's not about necessarily feeling scared for their personal belongings or their personal well-being, but also for taking responsibility. So it sounds like that is what your organization is trying to get people to do, whether they be in positions of power or if they're benign interactions in the street, are people who, you know, non-Black people, to take responsibility for their complicity in turning their backs on real Black suffering, Black pain, and Black humanity, frankly.
As a society, we all do good when we all do good. And right now, I don't know if anyone, educated or not, can say every person in this country is doing well or is doing good or is treated equally. I don't think as a society, how can we say we're one of the best cultures and places in the world where everyone is not equal? I'm not even looking to be equal. Let's be equitable. Like, how is that? What a fear is that? Fear of correction? Fear of moving forward? I just don't understand the people who try to lay on that, to say, well, I'm fearful. What are you fearful of? That you will be treated just like me? That someone will recognize you as the human being that you are? You're fearful of having that while we live that? While this is our existence?
And I've never heard anything from Black Lives Matter or from LIT, your organization, or from any really serious Black organizing group that would suggest that in any kind of meaningful way to turn the tables. You're asking for basic human rights.
Right. And, you know, it's funny. We, in our history books, we hear about this time called the Civil Rights Movement, right? Where, you know, up to that point, you know, people recognize that it was a horrible time for, you know, African Americans in this country, Black, you know, Black men, Black women, and all the systemic things that occurred to get to that point. And we were taught that after the Civil Rights Movement, it was changed. It's different. We're a post-racial society. We elected President Barack Obama. You know, are we? Were we ever? I don't want to get into a history lesson, but, you know, we have the 94 crime bill. Like,
Bill Clinton.
I can't even put into words how detrimental that was to the African-American community. That was a Democrat, Joe Biden, who's running for president right now, led that. Wisconsin.
And the Democratic Convention is coming to Milwaukee. Do you expect these issues, again, not to talk about, you know, electoral politics, but this will be on people's minds, certainly. How do you get that point across, or not, if, for example, the halls of power are coming to our city?
I think that's a very interesting question. And why I say that, it's not on me to get it across. I'm the victim. We're the victims. Why must a victim explain the harm that we've been on if we're victims? That's the whole definition of what a victim is. So again, why are we continuously have to bring to the table and relive all the trauma that we have to get things done? People are witnessing this for their own selves. The same fear people have of seeing what's going on, you're witnessing why this is going on. Don't the rest of the country see what's messed up? Don't our leaders see what's messed up? Don't our leaders understand why our protests are happening? Why people are in the streets? Why people are upset?
Well, it's very easy to get distracted.
So it's easy to get distracted to ignore the life of someone else?
Well, that's our responsibility in the media.
And not just you in the media, but everyone in this country. This is one to uphold. Again, why are we placing the burden on us to also explain and come up with solutions in a place where we didn't come up with the problem? Our existence is the threat. We sent a letter stating, one, the calling of the National Guard into our communities and not addressing the issue was a disrespect and slap to the face. It shows the racism and systematic white supremacy that exists within our current leadership. Secondly, we must start with the five demands that we made. The first being declaring racism as a public health crisis in this state and in this country. That's where we start at. We need to also, what is our number five demand, audit all our government institutions to identify those racist practices. we need to understand that this doesn't happen by accident. Reoccurrences like this, protests that continuously happen generation after generation after generation, don't happen by chance. We need to sit down and review how we operate as a government institution that's here to serve the people, because right now all the people in this country are being served.
Yeah, now I wanted to bring up something that was also in your statement, in your letter to the county and the state, that this isn't necessarily only about anti-Black police violence, and I really mean Black right now, not people of color necessarily, but, you know, people are invoking George Floyd, police brutality, but there's more structural issues at play here. You know, we've done reporting at UWM on the disproportionality of Black death in the coronavirus pandemic. There's issues with access to clean water. So, you know, when you talk about those kinds of intersecting and related issues that have a de facto racist outcome, how do you see that as in addition to addressing the issue of over-policing of Black neighborhoods?
So I think the best way to put it is, like, let's look at the decisions that have made these conditions. When the virus first was brought to this country, or like became mainstream and folks started to understand it, it was one that was carried from out of the country as folks flew in and were traveling, they brought in and brought in these communities, right? But the automatic rapid growth of coronavirus in Black and brown neighborhoods, why is that? Why was that? Let's look at the environments these communities live in. Let's look at how many hospitals were once in these communities and now closed. How many health facilities? You know, how many clinics? How many doctors? There are so many decisions that are made up to this point of closing, opening, removing places and entities that are needed for thriving communities, and other communities seamlessly have, that create the conditions that which we lead and have to address today. Police brutality is one issue that is fighting and should not be ignored, but let's look at the whole entity of a society and our current society. Healthcare, access to water, education, safety, all those things play part in each other to making sure there's a thriving society. And when one of those things are out of whack or disproportionately focused on a community, all those other things are impacted.
Daryl Gibson is a founding board member, managing director of LIT, Leaders Igniting Transformation. He spoke with Lake Effect's Julian Haida. Coming up next, we're joined by two filmmakers to discuss what to watch in order to help educate yourself on racism. This is Lake Effect on Milwaukee's NPR. Lake Effect continues on WUWM. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. If you turn on Netflix right now, you may notice that the top 10 film viewings during International Black Lives Matter protests following the killing of George Floyd are movies like The Help, Green Book, or Crash. But these films are not necessarily the ones to turn to in order to learn more about race issues and racism. While films are a powerful medium and widely accessible, it's important to watch films that give accurate representations of events and are made by voices of color, whether it be fictional or documentary. Yoruba Richin is a documentary filmmaker whose most recent project was The Green Book, Guide to Freedom. As a Black filmmaker, she knows firsthand that while film is a powerful tool, there still remain significant industrial barriers that attribute to systemic racism. Brad Lichtenstein is president of 371 Productions here in Milwaukee, as well as a filmmaker, and they both join me now to talk about the influence of film and to also recommend which films to watch to help educate yourself on racism. Brad and Yoruba, welcome to Lake Effect. Thanks for joining me today.
Thanks so much.
Thanks for having us.
So, Brad, you're a local filmmaker and leader of a production company here in Milwaukee that works to address social justice, but you said in a recent statement that that's simply not enough. So I was hoping if you could talk a bit about your recent comments following all the events that have since developed since the death of George Floyd.
Sure. Well, what I meant by that's not enough is it's not enough just to make films. it's really important to make sure that those films have an impact, that they bring people together, that they cause conversations and action around anti-racist work and how we can work on changing systems fundamentally, the systems that have operated with institutionalized racism for so long, and particularly systems that have also allowed police forces to be able to do what we all witness, which is murder men, Black men, without reprisal, and to constantly be able to defend their actions, which has to be changed. So that's some of what I meant by the statement that we issued.
And Yoruba, you're a filmmaker who explores issues of race, space, and power. Your whole frame of work is dedicated to that. And as someone who's been working on this topic for so long, in and out of the news cycles, but with this particular instance and the growing protests and the international call for justice, do you see a greater collective power of people paying attention now?
Yes, I think that is the one thing that gives me some glimmer of hope, even though I'm in this funny thing of, you know, especially when this all began, of feeling scared to be hopeful, you know, because we've been disappointed so many times. I just want to also point out too, in terms of what Brad said about, you know, witnessing Black men, that Black women have also been victims of this police violence and of state violence since the very beginning as well. But yes, I do think that we are seeing greater attention. I mean, you know, we're some of us, you know, are seeing this as a tipping point. The fact that things have happened so swiftly, I think, is, you know, is something new and different. The multiracialness of the protests is something new and different. Everyone has commented on that, from, you know, President Obama to Al Sharpton. You know, Sharpton's been in this fight for a long time. And that's one of the things that he said at Floyd's memorial, George Floyd's memorial, that's different this time. And, you know, we'll see, obviously it's the long term. We'll see what happens and we'll see what actually gets done after this moment passes. But I think there's cause for some hope.
So why do you both think that film is one of the best ways to explore issues and reach an audience, especially when it comes to issues of race and social justice?
You know, I think that we live, and certainly for my whole life, we've kind of lived in the media age. This is, you know, even before social media. There was no such thing as social media when I was growing up. But certainly media reflects, you know, impacts people in a way like nothing else does. And that's only increased. I don't think it's the only way. I don't think it's gonna, you know, save us. I think it has limits in what it can do as well. And that it needs to be done in conjunction with other means of education and, you know, consciousness. But it is the age, it is how people communicate, it's how people are impacted, how people, you know, see the world. And so it's a very powerful medium and can spark, you know, these kind of conversations and these movements. I mean, I think if you look at a film like 13th, that had an impact that was incredible for, you know, people who did not even, you know, weren't necessarily, you know, documentary watchers. And I think 13th, which looks at the criminal justice system and the history of it, comes out at a moment where we're talking about criminal justice. And this is even before, you know, the present day with what's going on, but that we are actually, you know, able to, and that politicians are able to talk about criminal justice reform movements. I remember in the 80s and 90s, where if you advocated for criminal justice reform, you were considered, you know, soft on crime. And that was from both parties. That wasn't, you know, just the Republicans. So all these things come out in conjunction with each other, and I think brings us to this moment. I think film is part of that.
And I would just add that I think in particular, independent film and the world of documentaries, many of which are PBS documentaries, take people to places that they wouldn't learn about in school or in their lives. And case in point, I was just before this call going through transcripts for a film that we're doing about the joint football team between Shorewood and Messmer, which Audrey, I think you know about. And the coach, I'm reading the transcript, and the coach is talking about Bayard Rustin, who is largely left out of textbooks that deal with the civil rights movement. He's Black and he's gay, and he was the organizer of the March on Washington, but we almost always learn about that in history books in the frame of Dr. King. So it was this character in our film talking about how he learned from a documentary about Bayard Rustin and also about the discrimination and the anti-gay culture that kept him out of the story that obviously changed the face of the civil rights movement in America. So those are the kinds of reasons why these kinds of films are really important to keep putting out there.
So let's get into some films that 371 Productions, Brad, you put out a list of films that people can watch from their homes right now to help better educate themselves. So Yoruba, since we have you here, I need to ask you, of course, about The Green Book Guide to Freedom, your documentary.
Yes. So my film came out last, oh gosh, where are we?
It was only last year.
Last February. And it's a documentary about the Green Book, which was an African-American travel guide that was created to help African-Americans navigate Jim Crow America, both the South, Northwest, and actually the world. It was started by a man named Victor Green in 1936 and was published through 1968. And it was a way to help us know businesses that would accept us, that were not segregated, places that we can go as we traveled, by car, but also, by train. This was the Green Book also mirrored the timing of the Great Migration generally. And it also was a compendium of Black businesses and businesses that not only served us, but that were pillars in their community. So it was a very important way that African Americans got around, but also that created these sort of, as someone says in the film, these parallel universes that we were living in. And so the film chronicles some of the businesses in the Green Book, the movements that were happening at the time that led to the passage of the Civil Rights Act in 1965, which, the Green Book then, when things were opened up and African Americans could go, there was de facto segregation was, outlawed. A lot of these businesses suffered, actually. And so instead of going to the local Black-owned motel, they would go to the Holiday Inn. So the Green Book ceased publication in 1968. So the film tells that story and tells the story of how this book helped build a vibrant Black middle class.
So Brad, on to you. Your film, Ghosts of Attica, can you briefly explain what that's about and the significance of encouraging audiences to watch this now?
Well, and I'll point out that, Ghosts of Attica is a film about the Attica prison uprising in 1971, and it prominently features the lead attorney for a group who came to be known as the Attica Brothers. They were prisoners during the standoff between prisoners and the state, which lasted for 5 days, and then Governor Rockefeller called out the state troopers who came in, and if you can imagine, they dropped tear gas on the outside yard, cordoned in by four fences, four big brick walls. Tear gas comes down, you can't see anything. And then the troopers came in with shotguns, which spread, the bullets spread 10 feet every inch, I believe, 10 feet wide every inch. So they were just shooting indiscriminately. And when it was all done, 29 inmates and 11 hostages, which were guards, were killed. And there was an investigation, and then there was a cover-up, and then there was an investigation of the investigation, and another cover-up, and eventually the truth came out. That journey took about 30 years, and we made that film at the 30th anniversary because the inmates, the Attica brothers, were finally getting their day in court, in which they were arguing for compensation for the damages for the people who were killed and maimed at Attica, which was just a bloodbath. It's also, from a standpoint of what we're talking about, kind of a relic. I mean, if I was making that film today, I have a much different view around who gets to tell whose stories. And I would have partnered at least with a Black filmmaker who felt comfortable working with me to tell that story. Yeah, back in that day, which was 1999 and 2000, I operated with a different sense of awareness and obligation around those issues.
Can I ask, Brad, because it's very interesting to hear, because 1999, 2000 isn't, well, I guess it's a long time ago, but then it isn't a long time ago, right?
Like, yeah.
At the same time. And thinking about what, you know, not just you, but what do you think has shifted where there is some recognition, you know, from in your life and, you know, from other maybe white institutions that people of color need to tell their own stories?
Yeah. That's a great question. It's interesting because I think I would hold myself accountable kind of in the way you just suggested, because even way back in 1988, I think it was, I was a student activist at my college, and we had a big discussion when we took over the school around issues of inclusion and diversity. Back then we called it cultural diversity. When we took over the school kind of in the wake of divestment and so forth, the organizers had a conversation among ourselves around this very thing, who should lead? And we made the decision collectively that students of color should lead. And that was both public and private, you know, behind the scenes as well. So it's interesting, you know, your question, like when I made Attica, I think at first, I probably didn't think of it as a Black film. I think I thought about it as a history film, in the sense that, you know, the Attica prison, I say uprising, I used to say riot before I started making the film, was a film about a moment in history. And one of my colleagues actually had sort of started the film for, you know, a different distributor, and then it changed and I got obsessed with it. I started reading the records. And I was reading the records initially from like a standpoint of, you know, they're investigative, like there were murders here that have never been accounted for. Mm-hmm. And then I met Frank Big Black Smith, who became a really close friend actually through the course of that film. And it's a long story. I mean, his funeral is one of the most profound experiences of my life. Mm-hmm. But as I was making the film, I think that I probably didn't have the language that we have now in our discussion within our community around documentary and decolonization. But Black actually put the big kibosh on my access until we had a lot of conversations around making the film. And a lot of those conversations were around, what's my point of view? You know, what's my lens? How are you going to tell this story? And it shaped the mm-hmm. way that we ended up telling the story, which was a lot about a kind of, it's very intimate from largely his point of view, and also a political conversion that happened in the yard during that standoff, where he came to realize what the audience comes to realize, that the state is racist and the state was bent on murdering. The language back then would be third world peoples. That was kind of the movement
yeah.
language, you know, without any expectation of accountability. So I don't know if I have an answer, but that's kind of, you know, the thought process that was happening in my own sort of personal trajectory.
So what about the film, I Am Not Your Negro?
So I Am Not Your Negro is a meditation upon race in this country. I mean, just race in this country. And it uses the words of the great James Baldwin to investigate what it means to be Black in America. I mean, and everything from racial violence to Hollywood representation to issues around masculinity. And it's just a beautiful essay film using the words of James Baldwin of exploring this issues and of all these issues that are timeless issues for African Americans. So that's highly recommended. And it is airing on PBS this Wednesday with Stanley Nelson's Black Panther, Vanguard of the Revolution, which is a comprehensive documentary about the Black Panthers, which, you know, is really important to know that history as well.
All right. And then with so many protests spreading internationally, the documentary Whose Streets would be a valuable thing to look back on.
Definitely. I mean, Whose Streets, I think, is really valuable as an on-the-ground document of what's going on, of what's happening in Ferguson after the killing of Michael Brown for walking on the sidewalk. I think that's why he was stopped.
In 2014.
And so a lot of the film, what's so powerful about it is that the film is uses the documentation that activists were doing, like from their phones and, you know, news reports at the time, really documenting what is going on. And it follows, I think, three or four activists, local activists, who are out there protesting for change. And if you remember at that time, you know, there were a lot of the things that we're seeing nationally were happening in Ferguson, you know, a militarization of police, curfews, vandalism, quote unquote, or looting, but it was all happening in this concentrated area, in concentrated city in Ferguson. And that film really documents the impact of these protests on these activists' lives.
Yoruba Richin is a documentary filmmaker, and Brad Lichtenstein is president of 371 Productions here in Milwaukee. There's plenty more to our conversation, as well as more film suggestions, and you can find both of those at wuwm.com. Coming up, a look back at a unique view of Milwaukee's open housing marches. Lake Effect returns in a moment on WUWM. Lake Effect continues on Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Segregation in Milwaukee can be traced back to discriminatory housing practices like redlining and racial restrictive covenants. During the Civil Rights Movement, there was a large-scale pushback against such practices. The Chicago Open Housing Movement and the 1967 Milwaukee Campaign, led by Father James Grappi and the NAACP Youth Council, contributed to the passage of the Fair Housing Act of 1968. This federal law prohibits housing discrimination based on race, among other categories. Today's protests in Milwaukee echo some of the same calls for equality as the marches in the summer of 1967. Margaret Rosga was a college student in Milwaukee watching protests on TV before the Fair Housing Act was passed. She saw news stories about the beatings of marchers in Selma, Alabama, and the murder of three Mississippi civil rights workers. Rosga today is a professor emeritus of English at the University of Wisconsin-Waukesha and the widow of James Grappi. She talked about these events with Mayon Silver in 2017, 50 years after the Fair Housing marches. Rosga says they inspired her to go to rural Alabama for a voter registration project in the summer of 1965, which later connected her to Milwaukee's housing protests.
Segregated housing was a boon for property owners and real estate companies. You had a rapidly growing African-American population in Milwaukee and a limited housing supply. Law of supply and demand, the price is going to go up and the quality doesn't have to go up. So people were making a lot of money. There was vested interest in keeping segregated housing.
So this was after you came back from Alabama, right?
So this is like 1966.
1966, sure.
Okay.
And Vel Phillips had already been in the picture. She was the first African-American and first woman to the Common Council, and she had proposed an open housing ordinance, right?
That's correct. Yeah. For the first time in 1962. So this is already 4 years after the idea has been introduced. And actually, there was a state fair housing law, but it didn't cover most of the property in Milwaukee. It excluded, I think, buildings with six or less or eight or less units. And at the time, Milwaukee was mainly single-family homes and duplexes, so it didn't cover those houses. How we shift it from looking at the enforcement of the building code to backing Val Phillips and the open housing law was that a young Vietnam veteran, Ronald Britton, came to the youth council. He and his wife, Norma, had tried to rent a place on 29th and Burleigh and had been told it was already rented. And
an African-American man.
Yes. And they didn't think that was the case. The ad was still running. So they kind of pushed for an answer. Is that really why, you know, maybe you won't rent to us because we're Negroes, which is a term used in those days. And confronted, the property owner said, yes, what she couldn't rent to them, what would her neighbors think? And he was a veteran, had fought in Vietnam. And if they hadn't had a 10-month-old daughter, maybe they would have just gone on. But I think one of the things that happens is you look at the next generation and you think, no, we can't let this go on. We can't have our children face the same problems we faced. And so they came to the youth council asking for help. The youth council, this was around Christmas time of 1966, went and sang.
And Father Grappi was already in at the head of the
He became the advisor to the Milwaukee NAACP Youth Council in the summer of 1965. So then we went to sing Christmas carols at the home of this property owner. Don't know what her neighbors thought of that. We probably also sang freedom songs.
No, this is the property owner who was refusing to have the veteran move in.
That's right.
Yeah.
And we realized that on a case-by-case basis, this would take forever, that the law that Alderman Phillips had been pushing for was really necessary, and so got in contact with her to ask if she wanted support, which she did.
So that was around 1966. And then in 1967, you started picketing aldermen.
That's correct.
And then Father Grappi spoke in front of the Common Council. And then I'm going to fast forward to August of 1967. And can you tell me a little bit about what's called Milwaukee's March across Milwaukee's Mason-Dixon line?
Yes. As you say, we had been picketing at the homes of aldermen who had African-American constituents but were voting against the law. And we thought we were doing quite well. We went from maybe 10 people on a picket line to over 100. But when Mrs. Phillips brought the law up again, they voted against it again. So we knew we had to escalate the campaign, and that meant taking it out of the African-American community across the 16th Street Viaduct.
What was the decision-making process that went around to decide to march over to the south side?
Well, from where the Freedom House was located and where this urban renewal project was located, to get to a white community, the near south side was the closest neighborhood to get that kind of reach beyond the African-American community. It was also an area that Father Grappi was familiar with. He grew up in Bayview, which is to the east of the neighborhood where Kosciuszko Park is, which was our destination. He probably made the suggestion and everybody embraced it. We could walk across the 16th Street Viaduct to Kosciuszko Park. It's probably a distance of about 3 miles. Nobody complained about the distance.
And what happened when you got there?
At the north end of the 16th Street Viaduct, there were a group of parishioners from St. Veronica's and friends of theirs, a church where Father Grappi had previously been assigned, holding up signs saying, "The South Side welcomes Negroes." They joined our march. So by that time, we had about 200 people. But when we got to the south end of the viaduct, there were huge crowds of counter-demonstrators.
Like about 5,000 people?
The police estimated 5,000 to 8,000, and we were 200. So what is that, 20, 25 to 1?
Right.
But my clearest memory of August 28th, 1967, was being in Kosciuszko Park, gathered around a couple of picnic benches, and a policeman coming up into our gathering, talking to Father Grappi, saying, "Father, would you say your prayer or whatever it is you want to do here? And then let's get out because we can't hold them." So the admission on the part of the police was that the white crowds were out of control. Well, what do you call a crowd of people out of control but a riot? So I think it's really important that when we tell the story of 1967, we make that distinction, because if we call it the year of the riots, then African Americans who were peacefully protesting get blamed for the violence, which was not what they were doing.
Right.
We did leave the park and walk actually as fast as we could through the crowds back to the viaduct. By the time we got to the viaduct, what I remember is holding the poster board paper, really, over my head to keep myself from being hit with bottles and rocks and whatever else was being thrown. And by the time we were on 16th and National, we were running for the viaduct.
Your protester side, the people that were marching for fair housing, were employing peaceful resistance and nonviolent protest, correct?
Yes. And we weren't actually breaking a law. It didn't become civil disobedience at this point.
Was it hard to remain peaceful during that time?
Well, everybody was intent on getting out of there as fast as they could. So I suppose there might have been some people who wanted to fight back, but it didn't happen. After that second night of marching across the viaduct, when we came back to the north side, it was no longer the refuge it had been the night before, because the police had blocked off streets saying there was a sniper in the area. And so that also became a site of tension. And then the police were going to disperse the gathering at the Freedom House, shot off tear gas. The house was old. The floors were wood and dry. What seems to have happened is that a tear gas canister exploded on the floor of the house, and the house went up in flames. So after that Tuesday evening, Mayor Meyer issued a proclamation forbidding nighttime marches. The Youth Council was going to abide by that rule, gathered at the Freedom House, which by now was not, you couldn't occupy it. It was
demolished.
Well, it was standing, but the fire had taken its toll. Fire engines couldn't get to the fire because the streets were blocked off. So there was a large crowd on the lawn of the house and spilling over into neighboring yards. Val Phillips did come. Father Grappi asked her to come because he thought that her presence would have a calming effect. And also to call attention to the law. I mean, it was her initiative to introduce the law, and that's what this was all supposed to be backing up.
Well, so, you know, the goal of these protests was fair housing, and it was to make unlawful the refusal to sell or rent a dwelling to any person because of his race, color, religion, or national origin. And so ultimately, after all these protests and after all the national attention that ended up happening, the Fair Housing Act, so there was a lot of sweat and toil that you put into that. And I'd like to fast forward for a moment to today because, you know, if we look at Milwaukee and if we look at how the neighborhoods are and how where people live, there's still de facto segregation. It may not be by law. So I was wondering what your position is on that.
Sure. After fair housing became the law of the land, there were people in a position to take advantage of that. The fathers of the African-American Youth Council members worked at places like A.O. Smith. The work may have been hard, but they were earning enough money to send their children to college, and they did. And those college-educated African-Americans began to get good jobs that paid well, and they could afford to move. So it was like a door opening, and a number of people went through that door, and then those jobs moved out of the city, and that door slammed shut.
You've written a book of poems called 200 Nights in One Day, and you also wrote a play. I wanted to ask you what you've learned from that.
I think the main thing I've learned is that the story has meaning and the story has power. And I've learned that partially in the writing, but more so in the reception of the writing. the students who were actors in the play, who played the parts. Well, a couple of interesting things happened. When the play was first produced at the University of Wisconsin in Waukesha, the African-American students who were playing parts didn't know this history either. The white students didn't and the black students didn't. But the black students went home, and to a person, they found somebody in their relation who had been part of it. And then the older members of their family or friends relayed the story to them, and they found it empowering. And they were proud of playing those parts, and they wanted to meet the original people because they felt they owed it to the people who had marched to play it right. They wanted to get it right. I was proud to have been part of conveying that story, but intrinsic to the story is that potential to empower people. And so now we're going into the 50th anniversary of the open housing marches, and I see it happening again. The people who are organizing events for the 50th anniversary were not born when all this happened. In fact, we talk about three generations, those of us who were there, those who are in their 30s, and then the teenagers who, again, are getting turned on by this story in ways that are so exciting to watch.
Yeah, I was going to ask you, what parallels, if any, do you see with the Black Lives Matter movement and the women's marches that just happened in Washington? Do you see any parallels between that and the times that you were in back in the 60s?
Well, I definitely see a parallel of when you preach the gospel of inclusivity. When you talk about fairness, when you talk about respecting people's rights, when you emphasize the positive of what we would like our city, our state, our country, our relationships with each other to be, people respond. And people respond in greater numbers than you could ever have imagined. It happened in 1967 in Milwaukee when people started to come from all over the country to participate here. And it's happening now. Love is more powerful than hate.
Margaret Rozga is Professor Emeritus of English at the University of Wisconsin-Waukesha and the widow of James Groppi, one of the leaders of the open housing marches in Milwaukee in the late 1960s. She spoke with WUWM's Mayan Silver in 2017. And that's today's edition of the show. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Thank you so much for tuning in today, and join us again tomorrow at 10 for another edition of Lake Effect, right here on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM Milwaukee's NPR. It's 11 o'clock, so stay tuned. Fresh air is next.